The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. You're a great guest, a super talented musician, a guitar player, and artist with John DeFaria. Yep. And before I go any further, sometimes it takes a nation to put this together. In this case, I want to give a shout out and a thank you to Shem von Schreck, Pat Bergeson, yeah, and Jeffrey Lee Campbell for tying us all together. Good guys, all of them.
My old buddies.
Yeah, man. John's career began in Miami, Florida, where he attended University of Miami Frost School of Music. He played guitar in the award-winning concert jazz band down there. The band director, Whit Seidner, recommended John to jazz keyboardist Bob James, and John then spent a summer before graduating touring with James and other University of Miami musicians. After graduating, John joined Gloria Estefan's band, the Miami Sound Machine, which, if you're not from Miami back in the day, that Gloria and that whole ethos just was like the guiding sound of Miami. John and his fellow musicians collaborated on the records and co-wrote some of the songs. John actually wrote Gloria's hit Get On Your Feet on a tour bus with a guitar and an SP-12 drum machine. John was drawn to Los Angeles after performing with Gloria on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and he moved out not long after. Phil Ramone, George Duke, Maurice White, and David Foster are some of the producers John's been lucky enough to work with. John actually won the ASCAP Pop Award for his hit song Get On Your Feet, and he also won an American Music Award for his for favorite rock pop group with Gloria and the Miami Sound Machine crew. He later toured with Kenny Loggins playing lead guitar and singing. And he was also on the road with Yes frontman John Anderson and New Age guitarist Kitaro's joint album project. Man, all these guys, Loggins, Kitaro, John Anderson, they always, you're in good pedigree, man. They're only picking the top guitarists, those guys, man.
Right. Well, I was lucky to, I don't know. I was right place, right time, I guess.
And great player too, man.
As a musician,
John's recorded on numerous movie scores, such as Holes, which is such a cool movie and book. That was like wonderful, man. James Cameron's Ghost of the Abyss, Uptown Girls. He's done commercials for DirecTV and Subaru, television shows for Lifetime, Discovery Channel, Warner Brothers Telepictures, and the Oprah Winfrey Show. Through his association with composer Dean Grinsfelder, John worked on the PBS documentary series called Ocean Adventures, which was wonderful. And that was cool with Jean-Michel Cousteau. Is that Jacques' daughter?
That's his son.
Son? Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, God, I remember that. Remember that?
Continue that lineage of, and in fact, his kids are now continuing it.
That's really cool.
Jean-Michel has a daughter and a son, and they're continuing that whole So they're now doing documentaries.
That was big. You know, when a Jacques Cousteau documentary would come on when we were kids, big time.
It was like, everybody sit down. We're going to watch this, right?
It was like, because they didn't have technology like they have now that he was down there doing that, you know?
I know. He was such an innovator, that guy.
Yeah.
To get that freaking boat and the, what was the name of his boat? It was a great name. The Calypso.
The Calypso. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And all the underwater camera stuff that he had, which was state of the art at the time. Yeah.
Very much, man.
So great, great, great television.
For sure, man. Yeah. And that show that these guys did, Ocean Adventures, that John did with Jean-Michel Cousteau, was nominated for an Emmy for the best music and sound design. John also scored the Warner Brothers movie Dukes of Hazzard 2, The Beginning. John continues working in film and television, composing and producing literally thousands of tracks for Oprah Winfrey Show, Lifetime Movies, ABC Family, MTV, New Line Cinema, ESPN, Warner Brothers Telepictures, American Dad, BET Networks, Lionsgate Films, National Geographic Channel, UFC, Fox, and CNN. John runs his production company, Baobab Music, and his studio. Baobab. What is that?
Baobab.
Baobab. That's like a tree, an African tree, right?
Yeah. Yes, it's an African tree.
I know more useless facts than anyone. and his studio behind his house in Culver City, California, which he shares with his wife, Shelley, and their three boys, Cameron, Sean, and Garrett. John, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate you coming on the show, man. This is like so impressive. Are you still using, have you moved beyond the guitar and the SP-12?
Oh, yeah. Well, the SP-12. It's so funny to think about those old machines I used to use back in the 80s. You know, they were, you know, the synths and all that stuff. You know, there were some amazing instruments that, you know, kind of like got the mojo up and running. You know, got the inspiration. And I just, you know, what I would do is have that drum machine, and I would just create a pattern, and I would just play. You know, because I was looking for, I was searching for songs for Glory, actually.
Yeah.
You know, and the tour bus was the perfect place to do it because there was just hours and hours of downtime. Mm. So I would just sit there and just, you know, mess with it.
Do you are you the kind of person I am? I have a hard time just sitting doing nothing. I'll find something productive to do, like what you did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always looking for, the exercise of the brain.
Yeah. I can't, to do nothing is not a good option.
Right.
Man, let's talk about that gig. How'd you get that gig? I mean, right out of college, nonetheless, that's like amazing.
Well, I was working with a great band at the end of college. I got in with a bunch of musicians in Miami that basically became Gloria's band, but the band, we called it The Company, and it was a band in Miami. And we were doing top 40 gigs, but we were also doing jazz gigs and original gigs. And, you know, and we were also, the band was doing a lot of session work at the time, you know, as individuals in Miami. We were kind of the band that everybody knew, fortunately, kind of like a popular band in Miami. And Gloria and Medio had a band in Miami as well. And their band wasn't too good.
Interesting.
But they would get all the gigs because Emilio was so shrewd and such a great business guy that he would get all the top weddings. He would actually get all the top, like, you know, quinceañeras and weddings and stuff like this. And we would always be, and they would pay like, you know, bucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we wouldn't get those gigs. We'd get, you know, these cool club gigs and stuff like that. But we always knew that those guys would always get the coolest gigs in town. So, and that went on for a few years. And then what happened was Gloria and Emilio, they went, they had a hit in Europe called Dr. Beat. And so they got invited to do a couple of television shows, one of them, which it was Johnny Carson. And they went out and did Johnny Carson. I'm guessing this is, oh, I don't know, 84, 85, something like that. And so they went out there with their band and they did the show, and Johnny hated it. He hated them. He thought they were, and they did. I have the video somewhere. And if you go, if you look at the video, it's really sucky. I mean, it's really sucky.
That's bad when the show host, who's not a musician, hates. Yeah.
Well, Carson was he was a bit of a critic. I mean, you know, he was not the easiest on a lot of his guests.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they came back to Miami kind of with their tail between their legs, and it didn't take them long. They came out and saw us. They said they told, I think obviously they had a conversation. We need a better band. And they came out and saw us, and they hired us like 3 days later. And so the two bands kind of merged. There were a couple people that they kept, but they kind of merged their thing with our thing. And that became Gloria Estefan and Miami Sound.
That's so cool, man.
And then from that point, you know, Gloria was still doing, you know, we were doing club gigs at the time. You know, it wasn't like she was, I mean, she had like a hit or two. She had like Dr. Beat. And then Conga broke. And that was the US hit.
Right.
And then it started to just freaking take off from there.
That is so cool.
And then it was a big wave that we all rode for like about 12 years.
That's why. Are they still together, those two?
Amina and Gloria, yes.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah.
They're still married and very happy. They have two children and a grandchild.
That's very cool, man.
Yeah.
What a good story, man. So that's such a cool thing that they actually came out to see you and like they wanted you, you know, you guys, that's really cool, man.
Came out to the club and watched us for, you know, for a couple hours and saw the band, and they were like, yeah, we got to do this.
This is
what's going to happen. Yeah. You know? And we were psyched too. I, of course, you know, we were young. I was probably 24 or something. I don't know. 23.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
I know I've spoken to a number of really sharp players that went to U of M, so I know that's a bit of a breeding ground, and their jazz program is well known. I was curious, did you go to school with anybody that would be a recognized name or that you maintain a friendship with?
Sure. There were a lot of guys there. Well, Ed Kaye, this tenor player, that there's just so many guys. Steve Bailey, the bass player, he's now the head of the bass department up at Berkeley. I know that. Oh my gosh. I mean, I could, there's so many amazing musicians who came out of that scene. And I'm trying to remember more. But yeah, a lot of people went on and had great careers.
Yeah.
Stellar careers. Rick Margitza, the tenor player, he's over in Europe playing jazz, and he's an incredible jazz musician. Oh, Andy Snitzer, who's an alto player an old friend of mine who was with Paul Simon for the last 10 years and is now with Chris Bode, and an amazing, amazing sax player.
That's funny, man. I know I've interviewed guys from Paul's band, and I've interviewed guys from Chris Bode's band. It's just, this is such a small world. It's really, really funny.
Yeah. Well, Andy's a great guy and a terrific musician. You know, I mean, amazing. In fact, he was with me when I did that short tour with Bob James. He was one of the other Miami musicians that was on that tour.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. So you've known him forever.
Yes, we've known each other. Yeah, we've known each other since we were 18 or something like that.
Very cool, man. So when you went out to L.A., and Carson invited them back, I'm assuming, to sort of like fix or redeem themselves?
He couldn't help it. I mean, Gloria, at that time, we redid Carson. I mean, she was huge. I mean, you know, she had hits all over the radio. I mean, it was on a whole different level at that point, you know, from her first performance. It became a whole, you know, I mean, it was, now we had a stage show. Now we were getting great reviews all over the country. We were playing arenas. I mean, he had to have her on the show, you know?
And you stayed out there pretty much. You left to move out there. What about LA like sort of seduced you, or, you know, that's a big move.
You know, I came out, it's funny because I never came out here on my own. I came out here, the first time I was out here, funny enough, was with Gloria. And it was probably when I was, like I said, 24. I don't know. I don't remember exactly. But I came out here and I was, you know, we were here for a few weeks and we did a few shows and I hung out with some friends who had moved out here and the whole thing. And I was just blown away by Los Angeles. And I didn't move, you know, and I went back to Miami for about another year or something like that. But I had it. I was like, I have to get out there. I just have to get out there. So eventually, yeah, I moved out here with my wife.
What actually. Was it? Oh, you were married very young.
No, I was. No, we were just dating at the time.
Oh, okay, cool. But I mean, you've been with her a long time. How long have you been with your wife?
24 years now.
Oh, congratulations. Woo! That's cool, man. Good for you.
Yeah.
That's nice. Yeah. Very good, man. That's a good accomplishment. I think I just hit 26 like this weekend. I think that's the biggest accomplishment I've had.
Yeah, right.
People don't, that's people who don't, that's a lot of, you know, if you're happy, it hasn't been, you know, some people are like 24 years and it's like, fuck, they could have gone to jail, you know, and like, dude, you only get 20 years for murder. But I mean, to stay happy, you got to, that's not like magic. Yeah. You got to work at that, man.
Yes. And it's even a lot more fun now because our kids are out of the house.
I feel you, bro.
So we're kind of like, you know, going back to where we were, absolutely, you know, before children, you know, a little bit.
100%, man. I know exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So you move out to LA and like, how did you get work first?
Well, I didn't. I guess I got a couple of gigs. Fortunately, as I'm remembering all this, fortunately at the time, I started getting some resids and royalties from my song with Gloria.
Oh, right.
Thank goodness for that.
Yeah, man.
Because when I first came out here, yeah, I mean, I didn't, you know anybody. I mean, well, I did. I knew some people, but I mean, to come to LA and start working as a musician, that's at least a 5-year investment in my view. You know, that's going to take 5 years to get established, at least to start working something, you know, some gigs. I mean, I did, obviously I did some spotty things here and there. Oh, and then of course the beauty of it was, I was out here for, in fact, when I came out here, it was when Gloria had her accident. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, I do remember that actually.
But she had her accident and it was pretty awful and we were all devastated, obviously, but obviously the tour was over. And we didn't know when it would start up again. We were worried about her and stuff. So I started, I came out here.
So it was a good time because it was like, sort of have nothing going on anyway. The downside risk is like a lot minimal than it might have been 3 months ago even. So let me check this out. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yes. That's good. So that's cool. Like it was an uncertainty, a period of uncertainty. That was a smart, smart to do it.
Like here with Shelley. Yeah. And we just hung out and fortunately, though, I mean, about 8 months later or close to a year later, Glory was better and she was improved and we did another tour. So I was back on the road.
Okay. So you had like a year of kind of like poking around, doing the odds and ends and trying to establish something. Then you went up. Yes. Thank God for that, man.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Talk about, like I said, you've played with some great artists. How'd you get the gig with these folks? And if you have any cool or interesting stories about working with them, let's start with Kenny Loggins.
Kenny was you know, once it was another, Robbie Neville, who became a friend of mine, a brilliant singer, guitar player. I saw him just a chance thing. I saw him in a restaurant. And he said, "Hey man, you interested in doing this Loggins gig? Because I'm going to quit." He was doing it at the time.
Like, how random is that?
And I said, "Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, do you think he? I went up to Kenny's house, like cold, and just brought my guitar and I played with him for like, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours. We just sat there, the two of us, going over his tunes, and I sang some for him. I played, you know." Had dinner with him. He cooked me dinner. And then of course, you know, like I said before, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I mean, you don't get that call right away, but you know, you establish a relationship, you know, and I think my first gig with him was probably, I don't know, 4 months, 5 months after that or something like that. And then the whole thing just kind of kept rolling, you know, he'd call me for this, he'd call me for that. Lots of side gigs. And then of course, and then there was a major tour that he did. So that was when it became, you know, a kind of sink or swim. And I was call to audition for it, because he was really, what he wanted to do was put together, it was the Unimaginable Life tour, and he wanted to put together a band that was more of an R&B band than a rock band. And so he hired a lot of terrific musicians. Most of them were African American, actually. In fact, all of them were, except for me. I was the only white guy in the band at the time, you know. But it was a wonderful experience. Perfect. Everett Harp, Don Wyatt, Kevin Wyatt, Moyes Lucas, Rock Dedrick, and myself. And it was marvelous. We were together for a couple. I don't know. I think that was that actual band was together for about 2 years, I believe.
That's pretty good. That's a pretty lengthy tour, man.
Well, on and off, I should say, you know, on and off. I mean, you know, and then it morphed into other things. And I was probably doing gigs with Kenny for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, something like that.
Now, let me tell you something.
I learned a lot too.
Like?
I learned a lot. I learned open tunings. I learned all about open tunings. I became a much better singer. I started playing mandolin. I started playing all different instruments. His ears are huge, and he hears all kinds of stuff. I started playing better slide guitar because I had to, you know, I just got deeper, deeper, deeper into it, you know? And, so yeah, it was really, really a great education.
Tell you something really funny. Do you know Chris Rodriguez?
Of course I do. He's the guy who was in the band before me and after me.
Chris, I asked him the same question. He goes, "It was really funny. I went over to Kenny's house and I just played with him for 3 or 4 hours. We had dinner together." That's what Kenny. That's his process, man.
That's the way he auditions.
Yeah, it was because I remember Chris saying, "I think he ran late, and I was standing there on the street in front of Kenny Loggins' house at my guitar, just wait." It's so funny, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's great. That's cool, man.
Yeah, yeah. Chris is a great guy.
He is. And John Anderson.
Yes.
Talking about royalty, man.
Yes. Well, that was with Kitaro. I was working with Kitaro. Oh, Steve Bailey. Steve Bailey, my friend, bass player, fabulous bass player. I was in L.A., and Steve... I guess Steve called me up and said, "Hey," he told me about this Kitaro gig, and I went out and I auditioned for it with Steve, and Kitaro was fun. You know, he was cool with it. We did a couple of gigs, and then once again, it was one of these things where a few months went by, and all of a sudden he's doing this record with John Anderson, and I got pulled into that, and we started. He did the record, and we went up and rehearsed. In a beautiful area in Colorado called Golden, Colorado, which is above Boulder.
I've been there. It is gorgeous, man.
It is. It's beautiful. And we basically took over like a little campground. And they had like a large, you know, kind of cafeteria kind of building. And we just threw all the gear in there with our sound crew and everything and rehearsed there for like about a month and a half. And then we went on the road after that and went all over the world with that tour. And it was exciting. It was refreshing. That was before Kenny. And that was the first tour I had been on since Gloria. And it was so refreshing because it was such the polar opposite musically of what Gloria is, which is this pop group.
Yeah.
That was like serious progressive rock. And I just felt like, oh my gosh, the other side of my personality can come out now. You know?
Yeah, that's really cool.
So, I was lucky to have that experience. And it felt really refreshing because I had just, you know, I just come out to L.A. I had been out in L.A., I don't know, a couple of years. And that just felt really, really refreshing to do something really different like that. You know?
Believe it or not, I interviewed somebody else who played with Kitaro. And one of the things that they
told me
is like, this is nutty as hell now. He said that the way he treated everybody was like just a first class gig. I mean, you know, accommodations, just it was just a first class experience.
Yeah, it was. He was doing really, really well at the time.
Yeah.
Had a great record deal. And, we had a great time with that. It was intense though. It was a lot of music to digest. It was not the easiest gig. And I was using a guitar synth at the time. It was a Roland thing that I had hooked up to a guitar, and I was triggering stuff, and I was also playing harp, I remember.
Holy shit. You played harp on that gig?
There were a couple of different harps that were tuned differently, and I would just pick them up, and, you know, there were a few little melody things and things I had to, but, you know, not impossible to learn, you know.
Yeah. That's cool, though, man, to do that stuff.
Fun to do. Really fun to do.
All right. Let's talk about, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording. From a business standpoint,
yeah,
I think doing the kind of licensing and the sync work you're doing is just fantastic. It's like, you know, the expression mailbox money, it's recurring revenue. You're building an asset base for yourself in your catalogs.
Right.
How did you first get into it, and what do you like most about it? And also, do you do composing on a variety of instruments or just guitar?
Oh, no, I've got a whole, I'm in my studio right now. I've got a whole setup with, sample libraries and computers out the wazoo. And, I play enough keyboards to I call it my typewriter. You know, it's
basically, I totally get it.
I play enough. So I do full productions. Now, of course I'm a guitar player, and I'm not only a guitar player, but I play a lot of different stringed instruments. I play banjo. I play mando. I play, I've got some steel guitars here.
Harp?
No harp. I don't have that harp. I get around a lot of different things. So that adds an element to the productions, you know, but I do a lot of, you know, stuff that sounds, if you go to my website, you can check out some of my productions and see, that gives you a good example of what I do.
And that's just johndefaria.com?
Yes.
Let me just spell it. It's John, J-O-H-N, Defaria, Defaria.com.
Sure. That's it.
How'd you get into this in the first place? And what?
Good question. I got into it because I started doing a lot of sessions for composers. I would be the guitar player on composers. And I started doing a lot of television for composers. And I guess, I know what happened actually. A friend of mine in particular, Richard Bowers, who was a composer, he would actually say, dude, why don't you, you know, he would have some guitar cues for some show he was working on. And he would say, you know, he'd be really busy. And he said, dude, just do those cues for me. Just do them for, and I would go, you really? and I remember, you know, working them up and doing them. And of course he probably had some, you know, he had some notes for me at the time, you know, because working in that field is a very different thing than songwriting. It's like putting on a whole different hat to write underscore. It's a completely different paradigm. But I did that and it was successful, and I started doing more of it. And slowly, and I really liked it. It served me big time. You know, it definitely.
In what way?
I wanted to follow that, you know, definitely.
What about it was so alluring?
Well, because I love composing. I just love the idea. I love the process of coming up with music that. And I like serving something with music too. I enjoy that process too. So the marriage of picture and music is something that I've been studying now for the last, I'm still studying it, but I've been studying it for the last, you know, 25 years, you know, and how that works. And it's music, I think, is like a third dimension to a production. If you're watching something, you know, you've got picture, you've got dialogue, but you also have music. It's like it adds another element of emotion to a production that is, you know, it just draws a viewer in closer to what's going on. And it heightens the sense of emotions around a particular scene, you know, if it's done correctly.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely it's like a liaison between the emotional, between the visual and the emotional kind of, And it's almost, it's got to be almost seamless. It's funny because now that, you know, I've interviewed so many guys that do this, I'll be watching a movie with my wife and, you know, I'm much more aware of background music because of you guys. And I'll say to my wife, I'll say, hey, do you hear that music? This is what some of my guys are doing. Right. And it's so cool because it's got to be almost... It's hard to be effective and invisible at the same time.
It almost is because it sounds so perfectly that it's almost like it was meant to be there.
Yes.
A brilliant composer can actually make the music sound like, oh yeah, that's supposed to be there. But of course he or she came up with it, you know, to out of thin air and just knew what the right touch, the right ingredients for that particular scene would be.
That's great how you just put that. It's supposed to be there. Yeah, that it's supposed to be, but it was put there, I could see from an intellectual challenge, you know, a musical challenge and intellect, the sense of accomplishment in doing that, because it is like putting a musical puzzle together in a way.
It is. And the teamwork involved in composing, scoring, I should say, the teamwork involved is pretty intense too. It's a huge crew of people and it's fun being in a team, putting something like that together. That's a lot. It gives me a lot of pleasure to, work with people. I mean,
if it's a good team,
if it's a good team. But yeah, I mean, you know, I've had, you know, great experiences and not so great experiences doing it. So, you know, it's kind of back and forth, but, I it's just something that really appealed to me at the right time in my life. And the other aspect of it, I should probably mention, was I was starting to have children and I was, when my oldest was born, I remember being on the road with Kenny. And I remember it was about, I don't know, he was probably 8 months or something like that. And I remember going to do some silly gigs up in the Midwest and going, what am I doing? You know, I just remember one night in a hotel room where I just said, no, I'm going to transition my life. I'm going to pursue this composing thing full time. And that was another time where I mentioned the fact that when I first came to LA, you know, I was kind of poking around. Well, there was another time when I was poking around too. It was like about 4 or 5 years later where I came back to LA and I just refused to go back on the road. And I got called by Al Jarreau to do a tour and I didn't do it. I said, wow. No, I am staying put. I am not leaving. I'm going to be here. And of course, the funny part about that is after 6 months of staying in town, people would call me and they would go, hey man, are you in town? I'm like, yes, I have been here 6 months and I'm not leaving. I literally took me about a year and a half just, you know, telling people that I'm here in town and I'm not leaving. I'm always here and just drilling it into people's minds because it took, you know, my clientele about a year and a half to realize that I was not going back out.
Yeah.
But again, so,
that's really cool. I give you credit for doing that because it definitely probably took a little bit of balls to.
Yes.
You know, especially when you have, you know, I know what it's like, man. When you need it the most, you're right. Like, well, I'm going to give this up to do something. You know, you got kids all of a sudden, you know, that not even the financial, just the responsibility shit that is in your head of you know, overwhelming for a young man. It was for me anyway.
Absolutely it is. It's a hard thing to do, but I'm a real believer in it. I'm a huge believer in when you close one door, you open another. It happens. And it ends up being the best decision you ever made when you look back on it.
Where did that come from, that mindset of, you said I'm a firm believer when you close one door. Where did that come from and why?
I'm not sure. My dad is a businessman. My dad's a businessman. I might have gotten a sense of the entrepreneurship that we were talking about earlier. I might have gotten a sense of that from him. He's certainly, but I also, I don't know where I got the, you know, the frickin'
Oh, yeah, that's an optimism. That's a very,
yeah,
like trusting. I mean, you got to like really trust the universe when you have that mindset inherently. That's where I was curious. You know, you can't just say, you know, you have to really genuinely believe. Oh, I'm going to.
There's a great book out there right now. And I you know, Brené Brown is a great author. She's a sociologist. She's got a PhD. She works out of the University of Houston. She's got a book out called Daring Greatly.
Daring Greatly.
And it's really about what you're talking about. It's about what it is it's, she calls it the arena, where you're actually in the arena. And basically that's a metaphor for being out in life and doing stuff. And there are lots of triggers that will come and mess with you when you're in that situation, when you're, you know, daring greatly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of voices in your head.
Oh, yeah.
That will, yeah, I mean, it's a human experience, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, every human can relate to this, right? Yeah. It's amazing. But to be conscious of that, those, you know, and to move through it and to just recognize those voices and call them out for what they are. They're just voices.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Anyway, that's kind of my mindset, and it continues to be my mindset.
I always try to study what success, what makes people. That was a big driver for me to start this show, because it's a fascinating topic, and it's, I always try to learn, you know, like, and I think it, my observation anyway, if you don't have that faith that what you just said, when I close this is going to happen, it won't happen. Right. I mean, you can be doing the same exact things, but if you're not saying, I know this is going to work, it ain't going to work. Mm-hmm. It's really weird how that operates. You know that, you know where that comes from, by the way, the arena, the man in the arena. It's from, it was just like a Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes. Are you familiar with the book?
I'm familiar with his, the man in the arena, the quote.
Oh, the quote. Yes.
Yeah. That's where it comes from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great exactly quote. Yeah. And anybody, like, yeah.
The critic, you know, don't listen to the critic. The man in the arena is the one I want to, you know, I admire, whether he succeeds or fails, he's daring greatly.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Which is a beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, idea. And it's I'll take that.
Yeah.
I'll use that.
Anybody listening, look it up. I think it's Theodore Roosevelt, The Man in the Arena. That's not the name of it, but if you look it up, you'll definitely find it there. I mean, it's a great little, I guess, poem or just quote.
Yes. It's, I think it's from a speech that he gave or something like that.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
We're doing all sorts of self-development shit here today, man.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's part of it. Being a musician, there's a big part of how you're going to do that. There's a lot of chance taking in this career. There's a huge amount. But there's a lot. Listen, in this day and age, there's a lot of chance taking in every career.
No, 100%. You know, any entrepreneurial, as I said to you earlier, you guys are entrepreneurs today more than ever. Any musician is an entrepreneur.
Yeah. So the musician is a DIY kind of occupation these days,
totally,
you know, completely. You know? And you've got to get on board with that, I think.
Or suffer the consequences.
Or you're not going to have a career.
Yeah, for sure, man.
Yeah.
Where did you originally grow up? Like, where are you from?
Well, I was born in the East Coast, but I think I call my home. My dad moved to Chicago when I just entered high school. So I went to high school in Chicago. Then I went up to Interlochen Arts Academy, which I didn't, you know, I forgot to mention. I went to Interlochen, which is a great, it's a high school for the arts. And at the time I was playing double bass. I was playing double bass in the orchestra. I was a double bass player. Played in the Chicago Youth Symphony. So I did have that background too. I had a classical background when I was a kid. That's how I learned how to read and that's how I learned classical music basically, was through the bass. I was playing guitar too at the time too, of course, you know, but I wasn't like, I was playing guitar in rock bands when I was 16, you know.
That's cool.
I was playing double bass with the Chicago Youth Symphony.
And guitar on the side in rock bands. That's pretty cool. That's great, man. That's just such, how cool is music that you can like do all that shit, you know?
Yeah.
Childhood was good. Sounds like
childhood was good. Yes. I had a great childhood. I was lucky.
Very cool. Brothers and sisters?
Brothers and sisters. Yes. I have one brother. I have two brothers and one sister, one brother who plays drums.
Oh, that's awesome.
Who's a terrific drummer. And, I have another brother in Chicago, Peter, who's a terrific actor, actually. So we all went, you know, it's kind of, we all went into creative stuff. My sister is the one who didn't. She's down in San Diego, Lisa, and she's more into she's into the online curriculum for universities.
Oh, that's so very cool.
She'll create an online curriculum for a university. Like, you know, they want to transition into offering their services online.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Man, give your other brother a shout out. You didn't mention his name. You said
I did. Tom.
Tom, yeah.
He's a drummer, a terrific drummer, but he works for Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. That's his day gig, mm-hmm. but he's a drummer by night.
Very cool, man. It's funny how, you know, you guys are all in creative professions, even your sister doing writing.
Yeah.
And your dad was a business guy.
Yeah. You were a business guy. Yeah.
No, your dad was a business guy.
Oh, my dad.
Your dad was a business guy.
Yeah, my dad was a business guy, but he always had a real love of music. My dad was like a kid in New York City in the 50s, the late 40s, early 50s. He would go see Miles Davis at Birdland or something like that.
Where'd your dad grow up?
He grew up he was raised in Ridgefield Park, New Jersey.
Okay.
Right under the George Washington Bridge.
Yeah.
And so he's an East Coaster. And, you know, he played football with his high school in the Meadowlands before the Meadowlands were the Meadowlands.
Yeah.
It was a swamp.
It was a swamp. Exactly, man. Yeah. Totally. I remember when they built that, man.
Yeah.
What were some of the bigger surprises for you, John, when you first started playing professionally about the business end?
Oh, wow. Well, when I was 24, I didn't know anything about the business. I knew nothing about, in fact, when I was now a little later, even later, when I was like, it was a few years after that, but when I wrote Get On Your Feet for Gloria, this is such a funny story. So I remember, I was on the road with her and I think this was like 90 or something like that. Yeah. It was like 90, 91 or something like that. So my wife, Shelley, who was my girlfriend at the time, we had a place together out here in LA and I was on the road with Gloria and she called me. She said, "Hey, this organization, wants to give you an award for Get On Your Feet." And I was like, "Well, who?" And it turned out to be ASCAP.
That's great.
I didn't even know who ASCAP was.
That's great.
I didn't know they were. So she went. So I said, "Well, can you go get it for me?" So it was like,
"Honey, do you mind? Can you pick it up for me?"
It was basically an award, one of the most performed songs of that calendar year.
That's amazing. What the award
was. Now, I didn't even know what that was.
That's great.
So, I started learning about the bit. I should have learned more earlier. I wish I had.
Yeah.
But I came from an era where the business side was not really talked about. It was all about like, you know, can you play, you know, over giant steps? Can you play, you know, can you play scale? You know, it was all about, you know, keys and scales and blah, 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 and technique and, you know, business for me, unfortunately came later, you know, but,
how did that feel like once that song blew up? Right. How did that feel is not the right word. Cause, what were your thoughts when that song blew up? What were your thoughts about that? You know, the whole experience.
Yeah. Well, the whole experience was interesting because I had written a lot of songs. for that record. And that was the only one that got picked for that record. And it became a hit. So actually, in a way, I was thinking, oh, man, I had some better songs than that.
That's funny.
To be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
I remember that's what I was feeling at the time. You know,
that's so funny.
That's kind of the younger mind playing with you, though. You know, I think as you get older, you appreciate and you're, you know, I have greater gratitude.
Yeah. Yeah. You're able to accept the wins a little easier, you know, and it sounds like you're like a workaholic. I don't mean that in a negative way, but you still think you work a lot.
I do work a lot. I don't call myself a workaholic,
though. Okay. That's cool.
Workaholic, but I do, you know, I have to work a lot. I mean, you know, I'm in here every day doing stuff, you know.
But when you're younger, it sounds like you're ready to move. You're on like the next thing. You're like, oh, why didn't this happen? Whereas when you get older, you're like, hey, this is nice. I'm glad I did this.
Yeah, exactly. appreciate more, right?
Well, it's
interesting thing about how you thought when you were, your thinking process in your 20s and your thinking process in your 50s, right? It's like a different.
Something. Yeah, but the other thing that's really funny is you're in your 20s, you think you have all the answers. Then when you're in your 50s, you realize you know nothing.
Right. That's so true.
And you have 30 years more knowledge. And you're like, shit, I'm like an idiot still. I got to, you know, I better stay awake. You know,
yeah.
I got a lot more.
Talk to my 21-year-old.
Oh, I know. The smartest kids. I got a bunch. Believe me, the smartest ones in the room. Is there anything – like, you know, everybody makes mistakes or pays tuition in their careers. I was wondering if you might be kind enough to share one or two mistakes you made along the way and what lessons you would have learned from them.
Oh, geez. Mistakes. Well, I guess, you know, if once again, it comes back to a mindset kind of thing. I mean, you know, if you can just learn how to appreciate, what's happening. And, you know, and the other thing that the other catchphrase that I actually mentioned to you a while back earlier was the whole thing about waiting your turn. I mean, everyone gets their chance to shine. I think it may not be your, you know, and when you're with a bunch of phenomenally talented people, not everyone shines at the same time. It just, that's just the way it is. And you have to just accept that and just roll with it and wait your turn, you know, because it does come around. That would be my advice, I guess.
That's brilliant. That's like very simple and very meaningful. Wait your turn.
Wait your turn. Yeah.
It's funny. I knew somebody who was going through recovery and I was talking to their sponsor one time and I was telling him, you know, I'm really concerned about this person. And they said, you know, they're going to get it, just not in your time frame.
Oh yeah.
And I was like, and that hit me. I was like, really? I was at the age where I was like, man, that was really good. Thank you for telling me that. And because I applied that to other things in my life. And it's very similar. It reminds me almost identically to what you're saying. Wait your turn. Your turn is not on your time frame necessarily.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very cool, man. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's talk about gear for a little bit. First, let's talk about some music. I'm sure you've seen a ton of concerts. What are the top maybe two or three concerts you've seen?
Two or three concerts I've seen. Wow. Well, obviously when I saw Steely Dan at the Bowl, that was a number of years ago. That was you know, something I always wanted to see was Steely Dan, and I got to see them. I don't know. My dad took me to see the Birds.
Oh, wow.
At the Capitol Theater in New York.
Yeah.
And I was probably 13 or 14. And it was just, you know, thank God he did that, because, I mean, it just opened my eyes to a rock show, you know, and I was a kid and there were people smoking pot everywhere.
I was just going to say, was everybody smoking weed? Yeah.
Oh, everyone in plain daylight. This is probably, you know, mid 70s and everyone is smoking weed. Around me, Dad and I, just watching this show go down. And, you know, everyone's a stoner, everyone's a hippie.
Yeah.
And It was one of those moments that I'll never forget.
Great and band.
The show, it was the Byrds, Rare Earth. And it was, who else?
That's
Eric, a guy named Eric Anderson was the,
yeah.
was the opening act.
He's great.
And then Rare Earth and then the Byrds. And it was just right out of the '70s. It was actually right out of the '60s, but what it was in the '60s, it was the mid to late '70s. Oh, and then I saw the Allman Brothers at Madison Square Garden. That was a great show. That was another one that I saw that was very impressive.
Your dad took you that one as well, or?
Yeah, he did. He yeah, did.
That's very
yeah.
cool.
Like I said, my dad was a real fan. He was a huge music. He loved, you know, concerts and stuff. He just
that's
loved.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you take your sons or one of them to music.
I have. Yes, I have. Hmm. They don't necessarily want to go with me now.
It'll come around, man. It'll come around. They'll come around.
They're older. But they probably will again. Yeah, they'll probably do that again. Yeah.
I just took my oldest, he's 28, to nice. See America two nights ago.
Yeah, America.
It
yeah.
was a great show, man.
Aren't they doing like some kind of anniversary show or something like that?
Yeah, 50th anniversary. They basically played like every hit they had, you know.
Yeah.
Really good. And I know the guitar player in there, Steve Fecchetti. I don't know if you know him. He's out in LA. Great guy and just a nice show.
Kenny did play some shows with America years ago. I remember being on the same bill as they were. But this is obviously going back in the 90s. But
great band, man. So many hits. And it was really funny because they were saying they played a couple of covers and they said, the guy goes, man, I wish we wrote this one. And then he plays California Dreamin'.
Right.
But it was a good show.
Yeah.
Hey, man, let's talk about guitars, John. What's your go-to guitar right now? And what other two guitars would round out your top three?
Well, I've got a 67 Stratocaster that I've had for forever. I bought it in Miami. And I bought it, believe it or not, I probably bought it in the early 80s for like $700.
Oh my God. Is it handy? Can I see it?
Yeah.
That's great, man. And I'll describe it to the listeners. Wow.
Yeah. Here it is.
Okay. Wow. That looks so cool. So it's a Burst rosewood neck. That headstock looks like it's brand new, man. That decal, looks like the day it rolled off the, that's so dark.
No,
that's 50 something years old. Okay, no, so body is really, really relict.
Yeah, it's a little abused.
Oh, but it looks great. It's
abused.
50 years old. It's perfect. The back and the, I mean, it's just gorgeous, man.
Yeah, it's a nice, I don't know, it's my go-to Strat. I have a Les Paul that I've had since I was basically 16 years old.
Wow.
This is like a mid 70s Les Paul, but it's,
so it's like, what's the Cherry Burst? Is that what that color would
be? Yeah. Cherry Burst. Yeah.
Okay. So it's
a mid 70s Les Paul. Anyway, I've had this guitar since I was like 16 or something like that. It was my first good axe.
It's a great guitar. It's a Les Paul Deluxe Cherry Burst.
Yeah,
really. Black humbuckers, no covers.
Yeah, these are actually DiMarzio. I put those in.
You put those in. Okay, so you got DiMarzio pickups. Yeah, looks beautiful, man. Your guitars are. I mean, they look great for as old as they all are.
Yeah, you know. Well,
is that heavy?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
As Les Pauls are, I've got some old. I've got you can't see it, but I've got a couple of old Marshall Plexis over here too.
Oh, nice.
That I've been using. I put my amps over in this. My heads are over here,
mm-hmm.
and then I just wire them through the speaker in the other room.
Sure.
And then I can I need to have it so it's like everything is like real fast and easy and plug play here's the track, here we go, get this out the door kind of thing, so I'm always about efficiency. And
you have to be, man. You're cranking stuff out. You can't sit around there dicking around spending 20 minutes on moving amps, man.
No. So everything is kind of like ready to go, switch it on, plug it in, ready to go kind of stuff.
Very cool. So you got your Strat, your Les Paul. What would be number three?
Oh, number three? Well, I mean, I I've got a lot of instruments. I've got an Ibanez, but you know, hey.
There you go.
I like a banjo.
There you go. I know nothing about banjos. Describe that.
This is actually an old Gibson 5-string master tune banjo, and another lucky purchase that I happened to buy in the 80s, also for like $800 or something like that. And it's an old Gibson.
So beautiful. The fretwork in there, the
inlay.
Yeah. Right. Gorgeous. Yeah. I can't even describe it. Just like very intricate.
Yeah. I can't tell you what year this is. Cause I never found out, but it's an older one and, it plays great.
How often are you playing banjo?
I just like playing banjo.
Cool.
It pisses people off. Cause it's like, it pisses my friends off. They go, no, don't take that thing out. No, don't play that.
Oh, I like that. I like the way that sounds.
Yeah.
Especially if you know how to do, I mean, if I would play it, believe me, your friends would be miserable. But I mean, if you know what you're doing, it sounds great.
Well, I don't have my finger picks, but you know, cause I practice, I'm not the world's greatest banjo player at all, but I practice with, you know, the Earl Scruggs method a little bit, you know, I get into it a little bit.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
It's so cool to see, you know, a studied, well trained musician, you know, practicing and, you know, trying to learn new things, man. That's always you know, school's never out for the pro, sort of.
One more little axe.
Oh, your little mandolin.
This is like a 1920 Gibson.
That is absolutely. So let me describe it. It's kind of like deep, like strawberry color almost, really relict.
It's an A4. It's a 1920 Gibson A4.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. And, you know, it's got a great tone. I was just at NAMM. I was checking out Collings mandolins at NAMM. Mm. They make an F5 model, and I was playing it out there. It's an $11,000 instrument. You know,
it's kind of nutty.
This one is not cheap now. I mean, I think I paid $2,500 for it, but I bet now it's probably worth $4,000 or something like that. You know, but
is in your opinion, is like is an $11,000 mandolin necessarily? I mean, isn't it all like specific to that particular guitar or that particular instrument?
Yeah, you're obviously paying for the craftsmanship, mm-hmm, as well as the sound. You know, yeah, what I mean, it's not just the, does it sound like an $11,000 mandolin? Not necessarily. You could probably half as much and get something that sounds just as good, you know?
And then I've interviewed guys like Jack Pearson, who played for the Allman Brothers. I don't know if you know Jack, he's in Nashville. He plays an $87 Squire.
No kidding.
You know, when I first started this show, he's the guy in Nashville. Everybody's like, yeah, but have you interviewed Jack Pearson? He's just a brilliant player. He played with the Allman Brothers for 3 years.
Wow.
And an $87 Squire. And then he has like a low end Flying V or something like that.
Wow.
So, I mean, I can't play any of those instruments or an $11,000 instrument, make it sound remotely like any of you guys. So, I mean,
you've got a nice red 335 behind you there.
It's not a vintage. It looks like, and what happened was I bought that. I was in Nashville and I'm not like a guy that knows the ins and outs of guitars, but I was with somebody there, John Presti, who's Tim McGraw's guitar tech. So we're hanging out and he's like, you know, MacGyver of, you know how these guys are, these Greek guitar techs. He's like MacGyver of guitar. So I say, hey John, you know, I saw this guitar on Craigslist and I know the Bigsby is aftermarket.
Right.
And I said, you know, so I had the image of an idiot like me in their garage with a drill sticking that in. And I'm like, man, I don't really know the deal. So we call the guy up and it was put on aftermarket, but the guy worked at Gibson. So he put it on right there in the Gibson factory.
Nice.
You know, so, and
it was done the right way.
Right. And so that custom made. That was put on at that time. It's a sticker, so it looks like an old vintage. It's not. It's like a 2014. It's a beautiful guitar, and it's probably my favorite guitar.
Yeah, and the SG is looking nice too.
Oh, that has got. They both have the same pickups. Funny enough, the classic 57s, which sound really. I don't know if you're familiar with them. They're great.
Yeah. Great
pickups, man.
Uh huh.
I love them both.
Nice.
I still can't sound like you.
I'm always trying. Keep moving forward. Yeah.
Ever sell a guitar you wish you can get back?
Yes. Yes.
Tell me about it.
I think everyone has, right?
Yeah, I think so.
I had a Gibson L7, which was a great jazz guitar. It's a big, big jazz box. Mm. It's like an L5. And I freaking got rid of it. What was I thinking?
What'd you get rid of? Needed the money at the time or?
I think I was like, I need a different, I think it was like, I wanted a different guitar. Gotcha. I wanted something else, you know? And the only way to get that other guitar was to sell that one.
Sure.
You know, when you're in your late 20s, that's the only way to do it, or mid 20s. So it was, yeah, actually it was, I was in college. So it was, I was young, but I had that thing. Oh man. Do I regret that?
Top three Desert Island discs, John. No particular order, just for today, because obviously this could change every minute.
Discs. Well, I'd have to put a Joni Mitchell record in there somewhere. I know that. And I'd probably have to put a Miles Davis record in there. ESP or something like that. Because that band with Wayne and Herbie and Ron Carter, Tony Williams, that was, to me, that was, you know, jazz at its finest hour, you know.
Such talent, guys.
Just ridiculous. And they were just, another record. I'm a big fan of Thomas Newman. I love his scores. So I just love listening to his music. And of course, what am I thinking? I got to have a Beatles record in there too.
all good.
Yeah.
Hey, what do you think was one of the best decisions you ever made?
Get married.
That's fair enough, man.
Actually, and to move out to Los Angeles. That was one of the best decisions I've ever made. Yeah. Every time I think about that, I went, thank goodness I did that.
Never look back. Yeah.
Never. It was just one of the, and it was scary. It was scary. I remember being very frightened.
Sure. Of course. You're a young kid. You're moving across literally across the country.
I literally drove across the country with my wife, who is now my wife. And, I was a little concerned.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
What advice did your dad give you when you moved out? He was supportive of it, I'm assuming.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he's always been supportive.
Very cool, man.
He's always been behind whatever I want to do. Yeah.
Tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Oh.
tough to ask an artist that question, you know. A creative.
Most about myself?
Do you know Adam Zimmern?
Don't know Adam Zimmern.
He's out, another guy out in LA.
Oh yeah.
I asked him.
There's a lot of us out here.
I asked him that question. He goes,
you throw a stone out here, you're gonna hit a musician, an actor, or a yoga teacher.
Yeah, a yoga teacher. That's funny, man. Or a musician who's a yoga teacher.
Or a musician who's a yoga. Right.
He said, how can I answer that question when I have so much self-loathing? Exactly. That's a very creative person to answer.
Oh man. I don't know. I guess my tenaciousness. I don't know. I guess that's what I like about. I don't really give up, I guess. And my empathy too. I'm about the other guy, the other person. I do enjoy relationships, you know. Yeah, very much. And the family too. Family's big. That's the favorite part, too, is my kids and my wife.
It's very cool, man. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Flip side, if there was one thing you could change about yourself, what would that be?
Well, the stuff we were talking about earlier, I wish I had I wish I had gotten deeper into that way of thinking earlier on, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm glad I'm doing it. I'm glad I got into it when I did. And you know, actually, you know, as we were saying earlier too, I wish the music business had been a focus of mine at an earlier age. I think it is now. I mean, my son is going through, is a music industry major at USC, and you know, he's learning all kinds of stuff that, I mean, I can't believe that, I mean, that I never got a chance to even remotely understand.
Do they teach him stuff like, just out of curiosity, like social media, like, you know, getting, how to get on, you know, how to, you know, put yourself on YouTube and the things to get, to get engagement and stuff like that? They do.
They're very on. I mean, it's really pretty groundbreaking. You know, music education these days is like a different animal completely than it was when we were in college.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very different thing. You know, it's definitely more pragmatic and, you know, more it's not based on principle. It's more based, it's a little more based on street. It's a little bit more based on the reality, I think, you know.
Thank God.
Thank God.
Yeah, yeah. Man. I mean, I just think in college in general needs to do that because, you know, you got to teach practical skills because, you know, college is not something you need nowadays. You can do self-study and learn a lot of stuff.
You can. And, you know, the thing about it, you know, funny enough, this conversation came up a few days ago. And really, college is, listen, it's only 4 years. You can't learn everything in 4 years. It's just impossible. You can learn some important things. And I view college as the place to learn the stuff that you're not going to learn when you get out. So that's, you know, the important stuff being, I mean, if you're a musician, the important stuff is, you know, getting deep into theory, getting deep into your instrument, practicing like a maniac.
Yeah.
Because you have the time to do that. You have, those 4 years are for you to do that.
Is he a guitar player? Your son playing?
No, he's not a guitar player, but he is a guitar player. He's a keyboard player. He's a guitar player. He's an Ableton Live, like, you know, master pro crazy.
Yeah.
He does these crazy, you know, young people tracks, millennial tracks.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think college is that time where you know, you're exploring, you're cultivating, watering yourself, you know, and, but you're not going to learn every, you know, there's a whole other education after college that's, you know, probably even equally or even more important.
Yeah. I would say more
obviously college is where you learn how to learn.
Yeah.
You know, and then you just continue that trajectory basically for the rest of your life.
If you're smart.
If you're smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a tough question. Has your life been different than what you imagined?
Has my life been different? Oh, geez. That is an interesting question. I'm trying to think what I imagined when I was 16. I mean, not really. I think I remember wanting to be a musician and just having blinders on either side. I just wanted to be, I mean, yes, when I was 16, I wanted to be a jazz guitarist. so I can play some jazz on guitar. So I guess I am.
But I mean, it sounds like it's what you wanted. You know, you wanted to be a musician and it's what happened.
Yeah, I did. And that is what happened. Yeah.
It's such a rare thing. And it's so nice when I talk to all you guys that you're living out your dreams. That's really, you know, how few people get to do that. I mean, it's a rhetorical question. You are fully aware of how few people get to do that. You know,
I think there are a lot of people living dreams that are also not musicians too.
Sure. Sure.
There are a lot of people, you know, enjoying their career, enjoying their work. That's, you know, it's just, I think it's important if you're going to do something every day, I say this to my kids all the time. If you're going to do something every single day, the rest of your life, you better enjoy it.
Yeah, for sure.
You better dig it. If you're not digging it, then move on to something else. My twin boys are at CU Boulder, and they're undeclared majors, but I have a feeling they're going to get into some kind of business aspect of the world. I'm not really sure what, but you know, they have to enjoy it.
Yeah.
I just think that's so important. And to me, that's part of it, you know.
How do you go to school in a weed legal state? That has got to be like, I mean, you don't even need it to be legal to have it all around you.
We're weed legal out here too in California now.
Oh, that's right. So it's not a big deal to them. That's right. That's
yeah.
Right.
That's we're weed legal here too.
We went to Colorado a few years ago, and we're driving down the highway, and my wife's like, I cannot believe how much it smells like weed on the highway. And I'm like, holy shit, that's wild.
Wow. That's intense.
On the highway. Yeah. It was like,
yeah. Well,
and they don't have that. It's legal here, but they don't sell weed. They only sell like oils, I think.
Right. In Tampa, right?
In Florida. Yeah. And it was funny when, so we went into the, it was like a weed barrister or barista. And
in Colorado.
Yeah. And I just like walked through, and I'm like very New York about it. Just like, sir, what are you doing? And I'm like, we got to get your ID. I'm like, okay. You know, I didn't know the formality of it. So I get the ID. Oh, yeah. It's just,
and you look at when you go into those places, you look at the buds and you go, man, I have never seen anything like that in my life.
It was crazy, man.
I didn't know marijuana looked like that these days.
Well, and the thing was like, you know, what do you want? I'm like, I want to get a buzz. Like, she's like describing this shit to me. Like, well, do you want, just like anything will do. We don't even really smoke very much. This is going to be like, you know, pick whatever, you know, it was amazing. It was like, what is that? Sommelier for wine. That's what it was like, a weed sommelier. As well,
it is.
You know,
it is.
What is the occasion? I mean, like, I want anniversary weed, you know. It was different. I had not experienced that.
It's an interesting time for in that respect. It's, you know, it's becoming like a glass of wine, you know?
Which it should be legal. It's crazy. You got people in jail for that shit, man. That is nutty as hell.
I know. Here we are. We have changed that around. That's for sure.
That's nuts, honestly, man. John, any hobbies or interests outside of music?
Wow. Hobbies or interests? Yeah. Well, I go to yoga. Big yoga fan.
Sounds like you do a lot of reading.
I do a fair amount of reading. I like to cook.
Man, you know how many musicians? That's the number one.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something about it that I enjoy.
Number one hobby for musicians.
And I like being a dad. I think my number one, you know, occupation outside of being a musician is probably being a father.
Yeah.
So that's a big occupation for me.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Hey, two more questions, and I really appreciate your time.
Of course.
Anything you regret not doing?
Anything I regret not doing? No, I don't think so.
Awesome.
If I haven't done it yet, I'm going to do it.
Good. Yeah, I always feel like the pain of regret is far greater than the pain of mistake.
Huh?
You know, I'd rather screw up than not do something. Can't get
right. That. Well, yeah, that goes back to the arena concept. Get out there and do it. You know?
Yeah, you could fix a mistake. You can't fix you can't go back in time and do something that you didn't do. You know.
Yes.
Last question, man. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional, and how much has just been a natural progression of aging?
Oh, I've been very intentional in the last several years of my life. I've lot more gratitude in my life, and that's been intentional. A lot more appreciation. A lot more just, you know, smelling the roses. You know, maybe that is age too, but it's definitely something I'm cultivating.
Good for you, man.
Yeah.
Is anything in particular prompt that?
Well, being a father it is a purging it's trial by fire, right?
Yeah.
You know, I think being a dad makes you you learn a lot of lessons being a parent.
Oh yeah.
And I've learned a lot from that experience, and I'm continuing to learn a lot. And what kind of dad you want to be, and how much of that is from your parents versus you.
And, yeah. And you got to think about that, because not everything you got was what you want to do.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you have to think about, you know, this is the way I received this message. Right. I don't really agree with that. And because it's easy to go on autopilot otherwise. And
I've been there where I'm like on autopilot. I'm like, what the hell? This is not the person I want to be.
Yeah. No, I hear you, man.
So that forces you to stop and think about what you're doing.
You know? Yeah, for sure, man. Listen, I really appreciate everything. I wish I had something to promote of yours. I feel empty, but I can't promote something.
Right. You know, yeah, like Jeff has his book. You know, I read Jeff's book and it was really good.
He's such really a nice guy, man.
Yeah.
He was talking about a guy who's experiencing gratitude.
Yes. You know? Yes. But I mean, the process of him becoming an author was learning something a little later in life. Cause that was not an easy process, to do that.
Well, the tough part of writing is the editing. And it's the same in songwriting. You could put stuff down, but the editing is where the blood lets, you know?
Right. It is. Yeah.
We're talking about, by the way, Jeffrey Lee Campbell, who wrote Do Stand So Close.
Do Stand So Close. Yeah. Great book.
Great book. And super cool guy.
Very, very enjoyable read. I mean, it's something special to be able to read a book from cover to cover and you know, it'd be a real page turner.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he did, which is really cool.
And his story is nice too, about getting sober and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Right. It's just a redemptive, very redemptive story.
What I also liked about it, it should be a book that every young musician reads, because you get a real sense of what touring really is. I mean, you know, he hit on some points in that book that I would totally agree with, as far as being out there and you know, it's, you become this whole touring outfit becomes the personalities and the relationships. You know, there's something to it that is unlike anything else. As far as, you know, it's not family. It's not necessarily your best friends. It's a working relationship. You're working with these people, but you're with them 24/7, which is this interesting.
No, it's unlike anything else, any other profession, for sure. And the thing that was good too is about, you know, the lessons he learned. Like, you realize, I'm on stage in front of 150,000 people, but, you know, I realized the hard way, this has nothing to, this is not about me.
No.
This has nothing to do with me. And, you know, you learn that, or he learned that the hard way, you know?
Yeah. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, man, let me just say this. If you ever come out with something, please come back on the show. I'd be happy to support or promote it, man. Anything.
I'm just a work composer. I my website kind of speaks for itself. You know, you can go on there and see what I'm doing. Go to my SoundCloud. You'll see examples of my work. You know.
Let me tell people where that is. It's at johndefaria.com, John, J-O-H-N, Defaria, D-E-F-A-R-I-A.com. And anybody listening, I'll tell you what, anybody listening looking for someone to do tracks, or anybody listening looking for somebody to write any kind of television scores, underscores, screenplays, get a hold of John. I'm assuming you have a contact button on your website.
Sure do.
Awesome. And man, thank you very much for everything. I really appreciate it. Absolutely. I enjoyed everything. And thanks for sharing your story, man. Everybody, thank you. What's that?
Namaste.
That's right. Yeah. You can't be a California guy practicing yoga without closing with a namaste.
Hell yes.
There you go, man. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it with a friend on your social media channels. We appreciate your support with that. Thanks very much to John DeFaria for spending time with us. I really appreciate it. And go support John and check out his stuff at johndefaria.com and his SoundCloud and everything else that's related to there. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.